So a couple of days ago, I got afflicted by my iMac's newest virus, which is to say that although it no longer shuts down willy-nilly, it will occasionally decide to not play video, and it will instead show a perfectly green screen. I've never understood why this is. I have never found anything I can kill or force quit or anything to kind of, you know, get the engine sputtering again, if you will.
Now, wait, if you'll permit me for a second, is it only DRM, like iTunes video, or is it any video?
No, any video. Like stuff I've taken with my GoPro, for example.
I wonder if it's like the MPEG decoder failing somehow. Because like, if you're just seeing green, it's like, this is like a placeholder that's put here, and like the GPU is told to render something here, right? And it's just not doing it. So like, I would say you have a GPU issue in all likelihood, but possibly this might be software, maybe.
It could be either or. I was also of the impression that it might be a GPU issue. And what will eventually happen is I'll be the first one to get a Mac Pro of the three of us, and that'll really screw everything up. But anyway, so I had whined about this on Twitter, as one is off to do. And somebody who I don't have in front of me said, hey, have you looked into audio plugins? Huh? And so apparently some random stranger on the internet had said another random stranger on the internet had a similar issue, but when they removed some audio plugins, it went away. And so the only audio plugins I'm aware of that I had installed are Soundflower, which I was using to try to capture a live MuteMath concert that I couldn't figure out how to download using YouTube DL, which we'll talk about later, actually.
Soundflower is a mess. Go ahead.
It is a mess. It's an absolute mess. And I also had the Audio Hijack, what is it, ACE or something, Audio Capture Engine, something like that.
Yeah.
So I uninstalled ACE, and more importantly, I uninstalled Soundflower. And I'm just trying to, like, shotgun approach, figure out if uninstalling any of these audio bits and bobs will fix my green screen issue.
I gotta say, TIFF's iMac Pro is having a weird issue that I don't know is whether it's software or not. It seems like it probably is. When she plays Netflix video sometimes, and sometimes Logic is running because she's now a podcast editor, and sometimes it isn't, but Logic is installed. As far as I know, there's no weird plugins or anything. Sometimes the video playback in Netflix in the web browser will basically run through the entire episode that she's watching in like a split second, as if it has no time restraint. So it just flies through and there's all the frames at once and it's done instantly. Sometimes this problem has been fixed by quitting Logic. So it does seem like maybe it's using the sound subsystem as the timing device for the video playback, and something is wrong with the sound subsystem. But this applies whether she's using the built-in audio or not. When it's in this mode, switching audio outputs does fix the problem for whatever she switches it to, but when she switches it back to the built-in headphone jack, the problem resumes. And sometimes it has happened without Logic running. So something's up, and I have the exact same computer across the exact same room with many of the same things plugged in, and I've never had that problem. But I never watch Netflix in my browser, so maybe there's something with browser video where it's doing something, but like I watch YouTube sometimes, and that never has a problem. So
has she tried Chrome instead of Safari?
Why would I do that?
To see if it's the browser.
But Chrome is gross.
You're just watching video. It's going to be a video window. This is like the first thing I would try is a different browser.
I think we actually did try Chrome, and I think it didn't happen there. But that's probably because Chrome is doing everything using the most CPU possible and ignoring all the hardware. That's my best guess.
All right, well, it's plugged into the wall. What do you care?
I mean, I care a little bit about fan noise, performance, efficiency. I mean, there's some caring. Also, Chrome is just gross.
Truth. Oh, I hope that part doesn't make the show because we're going to get so much email. Even though you're right.
I do have some video follow-up. I lost my first video today.
Did you go to try to find it?
So I wanted to do a quick video on how I roast coffee. Just, quick, like, here's how I do it. You can do it if you want. And I set up my Sony. So I don't know if I mentioned I got a Sony A7 III to be like my video camera.
Of course you did.
But anyway, it's good. But anyway, so I set it up and I was all ready to go. And roasting coffee takes about 25 minutes, but I kept having to like pause and set up again and everything. So anyway, so I was recording for probably about 40 minutes or so. And I get to the end. Okay, fine. I go look at the camera to stop the recording, and it doesn't look like it's recording.
Whoops.
And I was like, oh no, I forgot to hit record. that whole time, 40 minutes later, after doing an entire coffee roast. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Like, how could I have made that mistake? I decided, you know what, let me pull the card out and see if anything's there anyway. I mean, can I save this video? Like, so I plug in the card, and there is a 12 gig file.
Oh, God.
That is a few seconds less than 30 minutes exactly. And I thought, So I looked up, is there a video length limit on Sony A7 series cameras? Turns out, yes, there is. It's 30 minutes long.
What?
I did indeed press record, thank you very much. I had the first 30 minutes, but since it was like a 40-something minute video, and, you know, like the last 12 minutes of it are like the end of a coffee roast, I can't really do that over again very easily without doing a whole thing over again, and I didn't have time for that today, then I have to redo this whole video. Because Sony cameras have this fairly poorly documented limit of 30 minutes for a video clip, and then it just stops. It doesn't, like, start a new one, maybe. Like, it wasn't hitting like a file system limit like the way old ones would, like with the 4 gig limit. It wasn't hitting that. Like, it's just 30 minutes and it just stops without warning. So I'm annoyed. I know, like, some people in chat are saying, like, for heat reasons on the sensor. We've had full frame sensors for a very long time. We've had 4K video now for a pretty long time. Like, this isn't like the first camera that can shoot 4K 30. Like, this is not a very new thing. I don't think we should have limits like this for heat reasons anymore. That seems unreasonable to me. But anyway, I'm annoyed. But in the future, I guess I'll get one of those like large kitchen timers that you see like stuck to the wall behind people's stoves and just set it to 30 minutes and put it on the front of the camera, like facing me. So just every time I hit record, hit that so I can see and make sure like I'm not actually, you know, accidentally hitting that buffer. But it's very annoying.
I suppose I'll find this out eventually. But what exactly are you recording for 30 minutes while coffee beans roast? I mean, are you in front of the camera during this 30 minutes? Or are you literally pointing your camera at coffee beans inside a contraption that is making them hot for 30 minutes?
It was a frame of me next to the coffee roaster as it's running. And my idea was, I was shooting a bunch of B-roll with my iPhone, and my idea was I would use that track as the master track to sync everything to, but I wouldn't actually include all 40 minutes in the finished video. The finished video would be like 10 or 12 minutes probably, and I'd just edit out chunks of it when not much was happening.
But not much is happening the entire time coffee beans are roasting, as far as I'm concerned. Yep, they're still roasting. Let me check again. Mm-hmm. Roasting.
I use the rest of the time to explain things like why I roast, why you might want to consider roasting, you know, what's going on and what you need to consider, like stuff like that. Like, I use the time wisely. Thank you very much. But
all right. I mean, I'll see you in the edited video. And just I'm just thinking, you know, roll that beautiful bean footage.
Nice. Yeah. What is that recipe anyway? Does Duke still have it? Anyway, you know, it's funny to me hearing you talk about your Sony cameras, because having only held one of these beloved Sony cameras for like 5 minutes in my life, it seems to me like, and I can't think of an analogy that's just right for this, but it seems to me like the Sony cameras are wonderful as long as you can get past the asterisk, the double asterisk, the dagger, double dagger, and the seven other things that make them friggin' terrible.
What are all the asterisks?
Honestly, I have found very few things to complain about, and that's saying a lot. But this 30-minute limit just bit me in the butt today. But, like, you know, honestly, like, of my time using Sony cameras, like, there have been some that have flaws. Like the A7R II that I had was incredibly sluggish to render its files and to be able to preview what it shot. The RX1, the first-generation RX1 that I had an absolutely terrible autofocus engine that was very, very slow because it was contrast only and everything. So, like, you know, there were some issues here and there. But the modern ones, like basically the 3 generation, the A7 III and the A7 R3, got rid of all the previous issues that the other ones had and pretty much brought no new ones as far as I'm aware. So they're just awesome.
Wasn't one of them like you had 4 shots before the battery ran out or something like that? I mean, I'm obviously exaggerating.
That was the A7 R2 and actually the RX1. Yeah, those, I forgot, those had awful battery life. But the 3 series fixed that pretty well, too.
All right, so I guess my info is out of date. I feel like I've heard both you and to a lesser degree Steven say, oh, I love this camera so much, except this, that, and the other thing. But I must be making it up.
Well, look, I mean, if you don't know the shortcomings of your camera, you're not using your camera enough. Like, every camera has some kind of shortcoming or thing you wish was different. You know, that's just the reality of complex products like this that have complex interfaces, complex needs, where no two customers' needs or preferences are the same. You know, you're never going to be, it's like to-do lists. You're never going to be satisfied with whatever you're using.
Sure.
I can't believe Casey didn't read the manual for you and find out there was a 30-minute video recording limit.
The difference is that I was going to drive the M5 for at least a small stretch of time, and the likelihood that I'm going to be taking more than maybe 3 pictures with any of Marco's 16 cameras is extremely unlikely.
Well, you could just buy, Underscore has the same camera, so you either buy his or Marco's when the first one that gets bored with it.
You know, that it's funny you bring that up. I've thought a lot about, should I go like full frame or something? And the immediate answer to my question is no, because I'm too cheap. But I wondered exactly that, like when Marco inevitably sells off all of these via Twitter, you know, for reasonable prices.
Or Underscore, he's closer.
Or Underscore. But the problem is, I don't, even if I can get a body for, you know, $500,000, whatever the crap these bodies, I know new they were a lot more than that. I'm saying, you know, if I can get a secondhand one from Marco or Underscore for, you know, several hundred to $1,000, I'm still going to have to spend thousands of dollars on lenses, even if I, and I only have two lenses.
Nah, I would $1,000 in lenses, it'd be fine.
Yeah, so I actually got with the A7 III, so I still have my Sony lenses, my 35 f2.8 and the 55 1.8. Those are both amazing primes. I didn't put either of those on the video camera because I didn't want to have to like detach them, and I wanted to use them with my still camera. So the video camera, they had a deal. It was something like $1,900 if it was body only, but it was like $2,150 or $2,200 if you got it with the kit zoom. And I was like, that's a pretty cheap price. And the kit zoom actually reviewed pretty well. It's not bad. Like, it's not, you know, if it isn't going to be the sharpest lens in the world for like tack sharp photos, but for video, it's totally fine. And, you know, so for what you'd be doing, which would be mostly video with it, you know, the cheap kit zoom is fine. And you know, I wouldn't say that, you know, easily or lightly, but yeah, it's totally fine. Like, yeah, again, if you're shooting like, you know, photos, I would suggest a better lens.
Well, right.
I wouldn't even say you need to spend thousands. Like, each of the primes I mentioned is, I think, a little bit under $1,000. And I wouldn't say you necessarily need both of them.
Well, so for my Micro Four Thirds camera, I actually just upgraded the body, but I kept the same lenses. And I have, I don't remember what they are, but I have a prime and a zoom. I can't remember the details off the top of my head, but each of them was like between $700 and $1,000.
Yeah, so it's about right for a good prime.
Yeah, so I'm like $2,000 into lenses on this thing. And granted, I've had it for 4 years. Well, the Micro Four Thirds system I've had for 4 years now. So I shouldn't really complain about the money I've spent on these lenses. But if I were to go and get one of these Sonys, I presumably would want it to be my everything camera in the same way that the Olympus is my everything camera. So I would not only be using it for video, but also for stills of the family. And one of the places that the Olympus falls down, or at least the prior version, I haven't really tried the new version in this situation yet, but is low light. Low light on my Micro Four Thirds, it's okay, but it is by no means anywhere near the like synthetic light that the Sony just invents somehow by being full frame, I guess. And so one of the things I've been thinking about is, if I were to really just go all in on a whole new camera setup, should I do, you know, should I pull a Marco/Steven/Underscore and just follow in your footsteps? But I'm too darn cheap for the body to begin with. And even if I got the body, I don't want to spend another $2,000 on lenses when I have two perfectly good lenses that are for a completely different camera system already here. And I know that that's just the way this game is played, and I'll either need to get over it or not. But that's one of the things that's hanging me up. Hey, so I'd like to do a little bit more follow-up. I have a product review, mostly for Marco. I have tried your other most favorite product in the whole wide world.
I'm trying to think of what that might be.
AeroPress?
No, not an AeroPress. Don't be ridiculous.
Yeah, right.
let's not get too crazy.
That's his other favorite product, though.
That's probably accurate. It is not technology related, but it is. But an AeroPress is close-ish to what I'm thinking of.
The Patagonia MicroPuff hoodie?
No.
Tell you, those things are amazing.
It's a consumable, as in not...
I mean, eventually it will be consumed.
Fair.
By the earth.
It is something that I put inside of my body.
Huh. That's not coffee.
No.
Beamster cheese? That's real good.
No, it is not something...
One of those weird skunky beers Marco likes?
No, it is not something I wanted to put in my body. It was because of necessity, my friends.
Allergy shots? I don't know.
Oh, Fisherman's Friend.
Fisherman's Friend. I have finally tried Fisherman's Friend, and I would like to provide a review for you right now.
I wouldn't say that's Marco's favorite thing. He turns to it in his time of need.
I got some right here.
I think if he wasn't congested, it's not like he'd be like, you know what, I want some Fisherman's Friend.
Wait, are we doing some Foley work? I can do that, too.
Yeah.
So I've got my Fisherman's Friend. I have to tell you, these taste like shit.
Yep.
In the mouthfeel. And the mouthfeel is even worse. And part of the problem is I grew up on Luden's cough candy, which it tastes delicious, but does absolutely nothing to help a sore throat. But Declan has brought home something that has now infected the entire family. And lo, I needed to do something to fix a sore throat. And I thought to myself, self, several months ago, you got Fisherman's Friend because not only did Marco insist that it's great, but my real life, well, not that you're my real life friend, but you know what I mean? My outside of podcasting friend, Stee, had recommended it as well. And so I thought, oh, I should try Fisherman's Friend. They do work, but I am miserable while I'm consuming it. It is.
Do they work by distracting you from your sore throat with the disgusting taste?
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's what it is. I'm not sure, but I just thought I'd provide the quick product review for you, Marco. That they get the Casey stamp of approval in the sense that they do what they say they are setting out to do, which is to make your throat not feel like it's on fire, but not an enjoyable experience to get to that point.
Yes, I mean, first of all, like, I agree with you. When you first try these, they do indeed taste horrendous, which I believe I said in my initial review.
You probably
did. I will say over time you get used to it. Like now, I put it, you know, now that I've probably consumed like 400 of these things over the last three winters of sick children, it does taste horrible the first 200 or 300 that you try. But after that, you know, you'll get there. After that, then it's fine. It's totally fine. You barely even notice. It just tastes like a mint.
It's not like fish.
Yeah, right. yeah. All right. And while we're doing the Casey and Marco corner, can you give me an update on your car? Is there an update on your car? What's going on there?
There is an update. It is not done yet, but things have happened. So I had two problems that we mentioned last week's after show. Number one was that Tesla had not canceled my lease when they offered to renew it early. They left the old one going. And so I was being billed for a car I no longer had. That was fun. That has been partly resolved. They did indeed send a check that, well, it hasn't cleared yet, but they did indeed send a check that I deposited yesterday for the parts of the payment that I have paid already, but not for the like $5,000 bill that I got. I asked, and allegedly they have cleared that bill with the bank, and the bank should process it within a week, so ask me again next week. I called the bank yesterday, and they hadn't yet seen this, but oh well. Secondly, they sent a mobile tech out to my house, which is literally what it sounds like. It is a person who can service the car in a van. And so they drive to your house and service it at your house instead of at the very, very crowded Tesla service center. Mobile service has existed for a while. I know our friend Underscore has used it before. I had never been offered it, but for this problem, I was offered it. So that was really nice. They sent a tech out to replace my yellow ring screen, and it is now replaced. It is fixed. The guy was super nice, and that problem is gone. So I really, you know, I could tell based on some comments that the various people made that part of the reason that this was being fast-tracked was because of me complaining on the podcast and on Twitter.
Nice.
And I feel a little mixed about that. Like, normally, you know, like I'm fortunate enough to have a large following in these places, and so I kind of knew that I was increasing my chances of getting it fixed by going public with it. And so normally I wouldn't do that kind of thing lightly. Like, I don't like to just, like, complain to companies in public, you know, in that way. But because I had gone through the official channels for, like, 2 months and gotten nowhere, I felt like I was, like, at the end of my rope. And so I was like, all right, fine. I'm going to go public. I'm going to push that button. I'm going to use it. And I don't feel great that that's why it is getting fixed. But the reality is it is getting fixed, and I'm happy about that. And I hope they're right. I hope the bank thing is done. And when I call the bank in 5 or 6 days, I really hope they say this is resolved, because then I can finally complete this project. Like, I hate having things hanging over me, you know, like like undone projects. I have like this paper on my desk that's been on my desk for 3 months. Like, I'm just like, I want to get this done. Like, I just want to close this out and be done with it so I can get back to not only enjoying this car that I love, but literally anything else in my life.
That is something else. I understand what you're saying about not wanting to go nuclear and, you know, leverage both Twitter and the podcast, but I think you did right by them and gave them more than enough time to resolve these issues, you know, as expediently as possible. And they did not take you up on any of your offers to do that. So I think it's a good sign that you feel guilty, but you should not feel guilty. Like, I think you're fine on this.
I would feel even angrier if this is the only way a problem got resolved, because it's almost like I would prefer it if the status quo of just like slowly over the course of 6 months to a year, the problem was fixed and I would complain that this company is terrible and has bad service. But it's almost worse to me than like, oh, well, there's some bad PR. Oh, now we'll fix it, because that shows that they had the ability to fix it before, but didn't care enough to. You know what I mean? It's like worse. Like, the whole time I'd be saying this. What about people who don't have podcasts? Like, this doesn't help you be a better company. You think this does. You're like, we're addressing the PR problem. We're a good service company. See, no, this is the exact opposite. A good service company does not need you to complain about it on a podcast. It just makes me angry.
Yeah, like, I shouldn't have had to do any of this.
and they shouldn't be able to quickly solve your problem because you're on a podcast. Because it shows that the problem was just like, you know, this could have happened at any point. Obviously, it's not, you know, tremendous costs to them. It's just do it. Just do it when you're asked 2 months ago. Don't, you know, how long can we let this go until we absolutely have to do it? Let's continue to do nothing and be incompetent. Let this go for a little bit longer.
Ay. All right. And then we also have feedback, since we're in the Tesla section now. We had feedback from David Griffin about your mystery box in your, is it your frunk or your trunk? It's your frunk, right?
It's in the trunk. It's like normally the trunk has like these two like kind of support beams that come straight back. And then on either side of them, like between them and the actual outer edge of the car on the left and right, there's like these little cubbies and that you can put stuff in. Well, on the new car, one of those cubbies, the right one, is just gone. It's replaced by this giant enclosure that seems to have no openings, and it's just space that is used by the car for car things. And I had speculated, I'd asked last time during that big Tesla rant, I'm like, hey, by the way, my new car has this thing, the old car didn't. I can't figure out what it is. I've searched the internet, no one seems to know. If anyone knows out there what this thing is taking up space in my trunk for, I'm just curious. Like, I really just want to know. Like, I have about, like, you know, 3 square feet less of trunk space. I just kind of want to know why. And so apparently it is a subwoofer or a bass box, whatever that means. Thanks to listener Dave Griffin, who has given us lots of good Tesla info over the years. So yeah, basically, like, I mentioned one of the reasons that the new ones are more expensive is that premium sound is now required. It's just now bundled in. Before it was an option, and I didn't take the option before, which is weird for me, but I mostly listen to podcasts, and so I didn't think it was worth the, you know, $2,000 upgrade on the last car. But this car, you're forced to get it because they wanted to drive the prices up, kind of very Apple-like. And so apparently I'm forced to both pay more and have a little bit less trunk space with the new car.
Neat.
Still love the car, but if that was an option, I would have unchecked it.
Yeah, that's fair.
Speaking of frunks, we got a little bit of a follow-up from i3 owners, and I'm sure Mark read through all of it about his potential purchase of an i3, but I read through most of it, and the one thing that struck me, the one tidbit that struck me, and I don't know if this is true, we just heard it from one person, is that this person mentioned offhand, by the way, the frunk on the i3 is not watertight.
Yeah, I saw that in a couple of the video reviews, that it's more like a hood in, like, you know, like, if you open up your hood of your regular car, you might see like leaves and crap stuck in there. And it's because most hoods are not watertight either. You know, like, in extreme cases, stuff can get in there. And so, yeah, apparently the frunk of the i3 works the same way, that it's basically like a car hood. And so you can keep stuff in it, but there's not a lot of things you can keep in there because they can get wet, or
if you live in California and it never rains or something.
Well, I mean, you could keep, like, I don't know, like a first aid kit if it's in like a waterproof box or something. I don't know. There's stuff you could keep in there.
It seems terrible. Like, yeah, the hood of a car, yeah, that's where the engine is. Like, and lots of air needs to get in there and stuff to cool the engine.
Right.
But it's, if you have a frunk, make it watertight. Like, I don't understand that at all.
Yeah, it definitely seems like an odd choice, especially because, like, this wasn't a retrofit of an old gas car that they just kind of made electric. Like, they made the whole thing from scratch, right? Yeah, like, it's a whole new design. So it is kind of weird that they chose that. I'm sure they had a good reason. You know, maybe it was for, like, you know, like, the weight would seal it up all weird. Who knows what the reason is? But it is an odd omission to have a frunk in a designed from scratch electric car that lets water in, so you can't really actually keep a lot of things in there.
Yeah, it's not a choice. Speaking of trunks, we have more trunk-related follow-up. It just occurred to me.
Accidental Trunk Podcast.
Yeah, John, I really enjoyed your tear, I think it was over the weekend, going through the differences between your Accord and the brand new Accord. And one of the things you lamented was the way in which the Accord trunk, the machinery, if you will, the mounts that let the trunk open and close, intrude upon the space within the trunk cavity. And there are terms for this, which I've already forgotten, don't really care, doesn't matter. But I had pointed out to you that both of my cars are superior in that we have shocks on both of our tailgates, and they do not impede any of the interior space. So I would I would like you, John, to acknowledge that my cars are superior to your piece of crap.
You can't have a gooseneck on a hatchback. Like, it physically doesn't work.
Doesn't matter.
Like,
doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Doesn't make any sense. Yeah, it's going to be hinged to your roof. No, you do not get any extra points because they're hatchbacks.
Come on, Dad.
This is about trunks. You don't even have trunks because you don't own cars.
You know, I try so hard, ladies and gentlemen.
I wonder, has anyone ever done a gooseneck on a hatchback? I don't think I've ever seen one.
All kidding aside, like, that would be monstrous and in a not good way.
Like, physically, maybe you could pull it off. I don't think the roof is, like, structural enough to, I don't know. It would be madness.
I gotta say, I'm a hatchback convert. Like now that I've had the S for a couple years, like, I love it. Like when I was all mad at Tesla, I was thinking, like, what if I just, like, drive this car back up to the lot and say, screw you, I'm out, fix this yourself, and just, like, leave, right? And, like, and what would I get instead of this? And I was looking through the options, and I'm like, you know, I don't want, like, you know, in John Prince, I want a car-shaped car.
That eliminates everything now.
Right, yeah. It's like I don't want, like, a mini SUV. I don't want a regular SUV. I don't want a hatch, like, a hot hatch-shaped car like Casey's, and I don't want a wagon. And so I want, basically, like, a sedan that works like a hatchback. And there are a few.
A Panamera.
Yeah, there's the Panamera. There's the A7. But that's about it. Like, there's not a lot of other ones. And so I did think, I was like, I guess I would probably look at the A7 first. But it's not nearly as big. Like, it doesn't have nearly as much space. I have seen one before. I haven't driven one, but I have seen them in a showroom. And like, man, I'm like, I just, I, everything else, like, going back to a regular trunk would feel like going back in time. It would feel like a step back. Like, I'm so spoiled by how awesome my giant hatchback is with all of its cargo capacity without looking like a shaped vehicle I don't want, that I'm kind of spoiled by it.
You know, we're going to get feedback about people who are grumpy, or from people who are grumpy that this is not in the after show, but you know what? Tough noogies.
I love that CMF just pointed out in the chat the BMW GT series, which literally Tiff owns one. It's parked next to my car every day, and I didn't think about that in the list of
cars. And it's her second one.
Yeah, it's her second one. And I, for some reason, I didn't think of that in the list of car-shaped cars that have hatchbacks.
Well, it's because it's ugly as sin, that's why.
It's not that bad. Although I think the Tesla's a lot nicer. But
yeah. Yes.
It's not great. Oh, man, that is funny.
The 5 is way worse than the 3.
Yes, that's true.
Goodness. Like, what's really nice about the 3 GT is that it's based on the 3 long wheelbase platform. And so you get this massive amount of rear leg room. Like, you get, I think, even a little bit more rear leg room than you do, like, in a 5 series, but without having the width of the 5 series. So it still feels like, you know, the narrow 3 series width, but you have a surprising amount of space back there. So it's honestly, it's a pretty nice car. It's just, it's not for me, and it doesn't come any transmission I would tolerate, but it is a nice car. Actually, neither does the A7. So there goes that.
Whoops.
I don't know why we're talking about this anyway. None of these are electric, so it's not like Marco's going to buy them.
Yeah, I'm spoiled. True. Like, and I'm, because now I want a car-shaped hatchback that is also fully electric. Mm-hmm. Are there any others? Like, I guess the Porsche, not the e-tron. What's the, that's the Porsche.
the Tamarack.
The electric Panamera. The electric Panamera.
Take hand.
Yeah. Yes. If that ever comes up. By the way, we heard from people who, like, you know, I was having my problems with Tesla and their administration. We heard from a few people who tried to order the Porsche Taycan, formerly the Mission E, and it sounds like it is a total crap show of like trying to place a deposit, trying to place an order through, you know, you have to go through dealers to get them, and it sounds like it's a way bigger mess than my dealings with Tesla have been. So I'm not sure that would actually be an improvement.
But that car doesn't exist yet. That's all just people trying to get in line to get the first of a car that is even out. Like, those aren't anywhere yet.
No, but they're like placing deposits to place orders, and like they're saying like it's basically impossible.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, but it's like the Model 3 thing where they'll take a bunch of money for cars that haven't been built yet.
Yeah, yeah, basically. But yeah, so it sounds like if you want a car-shaped hatchback electric car, the Tesla Model S is actually the least hassle option to get it. Even if Tesla screws up the way they did with me, it seems like it's better than what's going on with Porsche right now with the Taycan.
The Tesla story that stood out the most to me was someone saying that there was an accident at like a Tesla dealership where one car like scraped into five other cars.
Oh, yeah.
And then all of them are off the road for like 6 months and counting because like none of them can be repaired.
Yeah, because the part to repair them all was backordered. And so that was painful.
And so they all have loaner cars while they wait. And speaking of loaner cars, I know we're stuck in a lot of pre-show NutriHill, but another bit of i3 feedback was that there's some sort of deal where if you get an i3, they'll also give you a deal where if you ever need to go somewhere where the i3 doesn't have the range or you don't want to deal with the range issues, they'll give you a loaner gas car for free anytime you want it.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
Which is kind of an admission that maybe your electric car doesn't have enough range, but, you know, because the i3 is not like the Model S. Like, I don't know what the range is, but I think it's like half, maybe less. Yeah, but anytime you want a gasoline car, you know, BMW makes those too, and they'll loan you one, and you can use it for your trip.
We are sponsored this week by Casper. The original Casper mattress combines multiple memory foams for just the right sink and just the right bounce. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper's own site, Amazon, and Google, Casper is becoming the internet's favorite mattress. And it's for good reason, because people at Casper have worked tirelessly to make a quality sleep surface that cradles your natural geometry in all the right places. These are designed by humans for humans. And they have three mattresses to choose from, the original. They also offer the Wave and the Essential now. The Essential has a streamlined design at a price that won't keep you up at night. The Wave, which is my preferred mattress from Casper, I love it, it's so great. The Wave has a patent-pending premium support system to mirror the natural shape of your body. Let me tell you, when I'm sleeping anywhere else, like a hotel or anything, I miss the Casper Wave. It's really, really good. All of these mattresses are designed, developed, and assembled in the U.S., and they're brought to you incredibly affordably because Casper cuts out middlemen and sells directly to you. And they offer hassle-free returns if you aren't completely satisfied. You can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. They have free shipping and free returns in the U.S. and Canada. They deliver it to you in a nice compact-sized box. You can get it upstairs. And then if you don't like it, they offer hassle-free returns. So check it out today at casper.com/ATP. And if you use code ATP at checkout, you can get $50 towards select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. Once again, casper.com/ATP with code ATP. Thank you so much to Casper for sponsoring our show.
What can you tell me about multi-output MIDI devices?
This was about Marco on the plane trying to watch a single laptop with two people with Bluetooth headphones. Couldn't get the Mac to output to Bluetooth to two different sources. And apparently, I haven't tried this, but many readers or listeners wanted to tell us, if you go to the Mac's audio MIDI control panel, which is probably someplace that people who don't do anything with musical instruments ever go, you can apparently make a new output device and make it multi-output and let two people with Bluetooth headphones watch the same video. That's what we're told. I haven't actually tried it, but it, you know, if I was stuck on a plane and trying to pull this off, I'd open that control panel. I almost said I'd open that preference pane and give it a go.
You know, and there was like a thing where like you have to like, you know, have one of them be like the drift master. It's like you have to like correct the drift somehow, and one of them gets to be like the master. Like, so it, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of issues that don't come up when you're using an analog headphone cable splitter. It sounds like it might work, but it's so much more complicated than just a headphone splitter that I worry that it might not.
make the new audio device and then just select it as one of your output sources. The main thing I thought about when I read it was like, this is yet another place where the iOS devices have a long way to go to catch up with the Mac. Because it's like, with the Mac, no, it doesn't do everything, but the chances of you being able to find some kind of weird hacky solution are much greater. It's just like, if iOS doesn't support this, guess what? It doesn't support it. You either jailbreak and hack something in, or you're out of luck. And in the Mac, there's a chance that there's some weird actual GUI buried somewhere that you haven't seen, or like a command line utility or something that will let you do this, you know, like, you know, kind of like the stuff with disk images and disk repair. Another example of the flexibility of the Mac, like there's functionality you probably don't even know about and you can add to it pretty easily. And, you know, the command line stuff, like, so lots of times the GUIs that Apple gives you, like their utility folders GUIs, will do stuff that you've never thought of doing. But also, if the GUI app doesn't do anything, a lot of them are just built on frameworks that are also fronted by command line equivalents that will do even more stuff. Like, I don't know how much I use tmutil, right, or hdiutil for disk images and stuff. Some of it is working around Apple's utility applications that they don't update very frequently, but the actual capability of the systems are much greater, and you have access to those capabilities if you know where to look and can take the time.
Yeah, that's one thing, like, as the iPad gains in popularity, and as we all try to use it for more things because the hardware is so cool, that is one thing I run into a lot of, like, there's this one behavior that I do on the Mac or that I depend on, or this feature I want, or this functionality that I need, that on the Mac, it relies on the existence of one of the Mac's many advanced features. Like, there's so much advanced functionality built into Mac OS of things you can tweak, things you can do, that on the iPad either are very cumbersome or very roundabout ways that you need to do them, or are just simply not possible. And I do find, like, I hit those a lot on iOS. Like, a simple thing, like, for instance, on the Mac, I remap a couple of keyboard shortcuts that are pretty common to be more comfortable keyboard commands for me to use with my actual hands. One of those is the screenshot, the Command-Shift-4. I put it on Command-Shift-1 because that's what I use the most, and it's just faster that way. The other one is I archive my mail messages using a different shortcut for archive than what this system one is. Again, just common action. I want it to be more easily done. And on iOS, you can't do that. Like, you have to just do whatever keyboard shortcuts there are, and there aren't enough. You can't remap them. You have to just take whatever they are. And there's everyone has a feature like this. Like, there's no, like, you know, services menu. There's no scriptability. There's no terminal to do a lot of terminal stuff. And, like, this is why, like, I don't think if you're like a real Mac power user, I don't see the iPad replacing the Mac for you. Whereas if you're just like a regular Mac user, like a more typical one, and you leave most things the defaults and you don't really get into those areas of like, you know, deep customization of the OS and its behavior, it's an easier transition for those people. But I'm unfortunately not one of those people. And so I think the iPad will remain for me a secondary platform that I do some stuff on and I enjoy it, but I don't see it taking over, even if it adds things like Xcode and everything else. Like, there's so much amazing flexibility in Mac OS that I would simply miss too much.
Real-time follow-up. I think I referred to the MIDI thing as a preference pane. First, I was going to refer to it as a control panel because I'm old, and then I said preference pane. Neither one of those is correct. It's in application/utility/audio/MIDI setup. So if you're looking for it, that's where it is. And then as for the keyboard shortcut, that's not comfortable, you know, Command-Shift-4, you change it to Command-Shift-1. When you said that, it made me remember and I hope I'm right about this, the origins of those. Why the hell is it Command-Shift-4, right? Well, it used to be Command-Shift-3, which still does screen, you know, the screenshot. When they added the capabilities of being able to do the crosshairs and the space bar to capture the whole window, they said, well, Command-Shift-3 is already taken with the just take a screenshot of the screen, so let's do 4, which is the next one up. Why didn't they use 1 and 2, you may ask? 1 and 2, Command-Shift-1 ejects the first floppy disk. Command-Shift-2 ejects your second floppy disk. And they've never gone back and taken those commands, because what if you, you know, I remember those were very important commands, and I always thought it was cool that, like, Command-Shift-1 would eject the floppy, but if you connected your $450 1980-something money external 800K floppy disk that you paid for half of as your combination Christmas and birthday present, it would eject the second floppy disk.
That is fantastic.
While we're going down this nostalgia trip, this episode is all over the place. Hearing the talk of Driftmaster reminded me of When I was young, we had a, I think I've told this story once before, but it was years ago. We had a Thrustmaster joystick. I couldn't tell you what model it was.
That was the best brand name of anything ever.
Oh, so good. But I don't, my dad would buy like video game stuff periodically just for fun and then never ever use it, which was great for me, but I don't know what possessed him to do this. But anyway,
I mean, that's literally like I buy a whole bunch of iOS games and never ever play them.
Well, there you go. So in any case, he bought this Thrustmaster, and I remember it was during the time of the PS2 keyboard connection, so that I don't know what that makes this, like mid-90s or something like that. But the Thrustmaster needed the old, like, humongous keyboard connection that were from, like, the original IBM PCs. Nice. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, like the big DIN something.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened was the Thrustmaster, you would plug the keyboard into the Thrustmaster joystick, then using a converter to go from PS2 to whatever the hell this other thing was called. Then you would plug the Thrustmaster in not only the special joystick port, which might have been on your sound card, actually, if memory serves, but nevertheless.
Yes, it was.
You would also plug it in to the keyboard on your computer because the Thrustmaster had a little app or program that you could do, like have it do key combinations or mimic keyboard presses with all of these different buttons on the joystick. And the joystick had like 8,000 buttons on it. And so this never really seemed like that useful to me until I started playing Descent, which is one of the many games that John could never play because he had a Mac. And
I played Descent. There was a Mac version. What are you talking about?
Oh, I was hoping. I had a 50-50 shot. And
I also played it on PC before there was a Mac version. But
oh, man, that's disappointing. I was going out on a limb there, but that's right. So anyways, so I was playing I would play Descent, and you know, when I gripped the joystick, like your thumb was on a, I don't know what the technical term for it is, but like a little four-way thing so you could go up, down, left, right. And so I remember that I had the keyboard mapping so that when I pushed my little thumb thing forward, it would go, the ship would fly forward. When I pushed back, the ship would fly back. And I believe I used left and right for strafe. And oh my word, was that amazing with Descent. Well, I mean, Descent in general was amazing. And if you're not familiar with it, you should like look up the Wikipedia article or whatever, because it was a truly phenomenal game. But using the Thrustmaster joystick with this ridiculous, like not really daisy chained, but almost like daisy chained, like that was Dongletown before Dongletown to some degree, because you needed to get all these little stupid converters. It was the predecessor to Dongletown. But so I guess that makes it Dongletown, England, and now we're in New Dongletown, America. I don't know, whatever. Anyway, the point is that it was this most ridiculous setup in the world with clearly like mid-90s technology, and it was phenomenal. I kind of miss it.
Descent was like an old school QWOP. You know that game?
What?
QWOP? No.
QWOP? Am I getting the name right?
Nope. Well, you might be getting the name right, but it means zero to me.
The game where it's like it's a side view of a runner, and you use the keys on the keyboard QWOP to control the runner's like leg joints, like
what?
All independently of each other, and the goal is just to be able to run, right? So you have to carefully orchestrate the limbs, and you know, basically the person just falls to the ground. A Descent was a true 6 degrees of freedom, like that was the gimmick of the game. There's no up, no down, no left, no right. You're floating in free space. And so without a Thrustmaster setup, you had lots of keys on the keyboard to control all the different axes of rotation and thrust. And it was very difficult to get a handle on it. You may be used to like first-person shooters. Oh, I can do this great. I'm really good at Doom. But that like constrained you to a plane, and then you would just, you know, left and right and strafe. Well, imagine you had left, right, strafe, but in like two more axes. It was really fun.
Yeah, Doom was actually an interesting case of it. Doom was actually a 2D game. Like
2.5D, they call it.
Yeah, like it was, everything was rendered in 3D. Like it looked 3D, but the maps were 2D, the projectiles all moved only in 2D. Like basically like the Z axis, the up and down axis, was only visual. You could never be like, there was never a room above another room on the map. There was like, there were enemies that were above you, but you wouldn't aim up or down. You would just shoot straight ahead, and your thing would hit the ones that are up above you, and they were shooting down at you. It was very, very clever use of, you know, not quite being ready for 3D, for full 3D yet, until Quake, I think.
The Colony had shooting vertically. The Colony was also raycasting, but you did shoot with the mouse. This was when Max had mice and PCs, didn't you? Did shoot with the mouse, and because you could shoot anywhere on the screen, you could actually aim above and below the dead center axis. But you've never heard of The Colony, but it was a good game.
Well, because it was a Mac game.
And it was. It totally was.
It might as well have been on Mars. Like,
there's an awesome video of like the person who made The Colony, like one person, because this is back when single people made games. A YouTube video of him going through The Colony, explaining what he was thinking when he made the game is, you know, it's amazing. Normally you can't even find, like, has anyone even heard of this game? Can I even find a screenshot? You can go on YouTube and watch the creator of the game walk through the game with you. It's really cool. See if I can find that video for the show notes for the five other people listening to this who remember The Colony. Guess who made The Colony, by the way?
The guy who you saw on YouTube or whatever? What was that?
David Smith.
Nice.
That's funny.
I mean, it is kind of a common name.
Fair enough.
I don't see any punctuation in his, though, so it's clearly inferior.
Yeah, and he goes by David A. Smith. I don't know, it's a little pretentious.
He's an imitation David Smith. We are sponsored this week by Linode, my favorite web host. You can get a server running in just seconds with Linode. You get to choose your own Linux distro, your resource level, the location, which data center it's in, and there's 10 data centers worldwide to choose from. Their plans start at just $5 a month. That gets you a Linode with 1 gig of RAM. They have a lot of things above that if you have higher needs. They have high memory plans. They have a whole bunch of standard plans. All of their servers run native enterprise-grade SSDs. They're on a 40-gigabit network, and they're using Intel Xeon E5 processors. So these are very fast servers, very capable, connected to an awesome network. They have VMs for full control. So you can do things like run Docker containers, encrypted disks, VPNs, or do what I do. I host all of Overcast and Marco.org at Linode. I've been a Linode customer since, I think, about 2008 or something like that. Long time, because it's just a really great web host. I have used a lot of web hosts in my career, and I just consolidated to Linode because it's better than all the ones I've used. Not only is their support really good if you ever need it, and not only is their control panel the best I've ever seen, but quite simply, they're the best value in the web hosting business. I've never seen a better value on an ongoing basis than Linode. It's just the best. You can see for yourself at linode.com/ATP. You can even, if you want to, you can apply for a job to work there. I bet some listeners of the show are in the business of wanting to maybe work at a place like Linode. Linode.com/careers is the place for you. But for the rest of us who just want to have web hosting, go to linode.com/ATP. Once again, plans start at just $5 a month, and they have a 7-day money-back guarantee, so there's nothing to lose. By using promo code ATP2018, you can also get a $20 free credit. So that could actually be 4 months free on that $5 a month plan if you want. So once again, linode.com/ATP, promo code ATP2018 for a $20 credit. Thank you so much to Linode, my favorite web host by far, for sponsoring our show and for keeping all my servers running.
Do you want to talk about, Marco, what's going on with Overcast these days? Because it sounds like you had a really, really, really crummy bug, and crummy in the sense that it would be hard to reproduce and kind of figure out what's going on. So maybe this is not that interesting, but I'd love to kind of hear you walk us through what was the bug report and how did you go about trying to figure this out?
So I've had reports for a little while now that they would be playing a podcast, and a few minutes into playing it, it would just get killed in the background if we're using too much CPU usage. I couldn't figure it out. For a while, I thought it was watch transcodes, and so I adjusted the throttling of the watch transcode engine to make sure, like, it definitely wouldn't go past the limit of... If you're in the background, the limit is something like 80% over 60 seconds, something like that. I forget the exact number, but it's in that ballpark. I kept having these crash logs, these reports, and when you get killed for energy usage or, you know, one of those resource limits, the crash logs you get are not very useful. There's not a lot of info in them. You kind of have to blindly figure out why might you have used that much CPU usage, because the logs you get usually won't tell you. So I was trying to figure this out, and you know, again, I blamed the watch thing for a while. I throttled that back, but I was still getting some reports of this. I was at my wits, and I could not figure it out. I poured through the reports, couldn't get any useful information out of the reports I had. So I finally went to Twitter with the Overcast, kind of like, hey, I'm getting these reports of crashing in the background during playback. I cannot figure this out. Can anybody tell me steps that reproduce the problem, that do it every time? A few people actually did, and by the way, I should clarify right up front, I don't know if this is the only reason Overcast gets killed in the background for too much CPU usage, but one of the reasons it could do this, I have now identified and fixed, and it's in the test flight beta as of today. I'm hoping to see if that does fix it after a few days of crash logs from test flight, but I don't know yet. Anyway, so the problem was, all right, I'm trying to think, like, how much explanation should I give here, because it could get really long and boring. So I'm going to try to, like, pare it back and summarize it. Basically, the one of the conditions that could cause this was if you are in a streaming mode where you are downloading the podcast as it's playing and it's not fully downloaded yet. And the app is in the background. So suppose you hit play, it starts playing. You put the phone in your pocket, so the app's in the background. If you pause playback, iOS will suspend the app in the background after a few seconds of no audio playing from it. So as the download was happening, if you paused it and the download wasn't going to finish in that time, iOS killed the app, which kills the download. It stops the network transfer. When you would go to press play after that, it would resume playback, but the part of the file that wasn't downloaded, Overcast would basically get into an infinite loop in a background thread, trying really, really hard as like a busy wait, saying, are you done yet? Are you done yet? Are you done yet? And it was like looping over and over and over again, rather than doing like a throttled, like check now and, you know, check back later kind of approach. And so there was basically a way for it to, after a failed transfer in the background, it was not properly interpreting that failure and was instead doing this infinite loop thing, which was making one thread max out. So the symptom would be, if you resumed a podcast under these conditions, if you resume playback, about 48 seconds in, the app would get killed and playback would stop. And if you hit play again, it would relaunch in the background and start playing again. So it seemed to you, the user, as if, you know, it stops playing after a minute or two for some reason. But that was the actual cause that I could finally reproduce. Thank you very much to the people who reported that. Again, I don't know if there's any other ones. I don't know if this topic is even interesting enough to keep in the show, but that's what happened.
Well, so hold on. So how did you figure out the technical bits that were going on? Because all you really had to go on was just that, I backgrounded the app, I was streaming, and then bad things happened. So how did you dive into finding the actual problem?
It never showed up for me in my own usage of the app. And there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, one is which I don't use streaming. I download everything. So I the only time I ever stream a podcast in normal use, unless I'm testing some streaming feature, the only time I ever stream a podcast is if I want to start playing something immediately that I hadn't yet downloaded. Like if I heard of a new episode of a new show, I just want to start playing it right now. So I go hit play and it'll stream it. The other thing is usually I have pretty good connectivity. Usually, like, you know, at home I have really fast Wi-Fi. When I'm out, you know, I live. You know, in a nice suburban area, so there's usually, like, you know, strong cell signal and everything. So, like, normally I wouldn't even hit the problem where, you know, the partial download hasn't completed yet when you pause it for a little while. And so I wasn't seeing this problem at all. When I finally got these reproduction steps, it allowed me to... So first of all, like, I tried it and I realized, oh, this is not happening when I do it on my regular Wi-Fi. But there's this wonderful utility that used to be just on the Mac and now is also in the iOS developer menu called Network Link Conditioner. Apple supplies this. It's a pref pane on macOS, although honestly, I couldn't get the macOS version to work under Mojave. Maybe I have to update it. I don't know. But on iOS, if you go into, you know, the developer menu and settings, there's a Network Link Conditioner, and you can basically artificially throttle your own network connection for all apps on the device in order to test how your app behaves in... you know, under slow networks or intermittent connectivity or heavy packet loss or other kind of like crappy network connectivity. It's a wonderful tool. And without that, I would have had a much harder time testing this. I would have had to do some kind of like router hack maybe or throttle it in the app somehow. It would have been much harder. So anyway, thank you very much, random Apple employee who makes Network Link Conditioner. Anyway, I was able to slow down my connection to like 3G speeds, which would give it enough time to get the app suspended into the background without the file being fully downloaded. Then I was able to relaunch it, and then I saw, finally, I could see this happening on my own phone, where I saw the CPU usage spike to 100% and then eventually get killed. Now, once you can this is why, like, you know, developers always love a reproducible list of steps that, like, do this, this, and this, and it will make the problem happen every time. Because then we can plug in our developer tools and we can profile the app. And so I ran it in Instruments, which is a tool that comes with the Xcode bundle. And Instruments can tell you if you run a session of your app under Instruments, it will tell you what parts of the app are using the most CPU usage. And this is, you know, for any developers who use it. I know this is a gross oversimplification. It can actually do a lot more than that. But the most common thing that I do with Instruments is measure where in my app is using the most CPU time, where, you know, what is using the most processor resources. And so when I was able to run this finally in a reproducible way, I could run it with instruments running. And so I saw when the CPU spiked to 100%, I was able to profile what it was actually doing in that. And that's when I saw, oh, it's calling this render method over and over and over and over again. It definitely should not be calling this much. What's going on? Basically, the root issue was that at some point I'm returning zero audio samples when the rest of the audio engine expects there to be some, whether it's, you know, a block of silence or not. But I was returning zero audio samples, so it would just call it again until it had enough to fill its buffer, which it never did. The reason why I was so surprised when I found this out, when I found out why it was doing this, is it's been that way for a while. And I wondered, like, why is this only a problem now? Looking at this code, like, this should never have worked. And while I was in there, I also decided to fix a couple of other things. Like, basically, the fix was the app needed better detection of whether it was in, like, a buffering kind of state or not. Like, is it waiting for more data or is it not waiting for more data? Fixing that required a whole bunch of actually surprisingly deep changes, which is why I'm going to do a big beta of this before I release it. But it's one of the things where it's like, how did this ever work? And, like, the UI for buffering was totally broken before. Like, it would show an activity spinner beneath the pause button.
Nice.
Like, partially overlapped by the pause button. Like, I kind of I'm embarrassed that I ever shipped that, honestly. But anyway, so the app had pretty poor detection before of whether it was buffering or not. So I fixed that as well. And so, which was kind of required to fix the real issue. So anyway, so I think I have fixed it. It was all because I finally had reproduction steps. And so for anybody out there who's filing bug reports, if you can come up with reproducible steps, and I know it's hard, and I know it's impossible to do for, like, bugs that just seem to happen intermittently, but man, if you have reproduction steps that reproduce the problem every single time, that is invaluable for a developer, and that can help get a problem solved way faster.
I find this really fascinating. Out of curiosity, and I've been messing around with something that I don't think I'm ever going to release, but it's I wrote myself an iPad app since actually we last spoke in order to help.
Wait,
with
what? Back up. Well,
so I when I do what I call the edit for analog, which is not actually an edit at all, and it's what I used to do for ATP in the first couple of years of ATP, and then Marco kind of took over in a good way, and so I don't have to do it for ATP anymore. But for analog,
I stole the edit from you.
I appreciate what you're saying, but I don't think that's the case at all. I think it was better for everyone this way, and you were able to dedicate the extra time to do it. But all that aside,
it's not you, it's me.
So, so the flow with analog is we record, and then I listen to the recorded version, straight off the mics, and I say, oh, at 15 seconds, I coughed at 5 minutes and 42 seconds. We cross-talked real bad and so on and so forth. And I generate this list of edit points that Mike is the one who does the actual work. I used to do this by just having a text edit window open on my Mac and listening to the show. And, when I heard something, I would not have the window open because I'm usually multitasking. And so then I would have to find the space that has the player window and then back up a few seconds to get the correct timestamp and so on and so forth. And I thought to myself, there's got to be a better way to do this, and it would be kind of neat to be able to do this on the iPad. And so I built this little app that will let me ingest a file from, say, the Files app, which really means like Dropbox or iCloud Drive, load it up, and let me play it, and then I have a humongous, like literally a quarter of the screen is a button that reads new edit. And when I tap that button, it'll pause playback, take note of the timestamp, and throw up a little popover where I can say, oh, I want there to be a chapter start here, or I want there to be like a sponsor read here, or there is a sponsor read here, or I coughed, or whatever the case may be. I bring all this up to ask, I'm curious, Marco, what do you do? And I feel like I've asked this before, but I don't remember your answer. What do you do for like bug tracking, issue management, stuff like that. Because I have this right now in a private... I'm trying to be gentle, John.
You're asking the person who doesn't run any tests what he uses for bug tracking, okay?
Well, I'm trying to be gentle here. And before you answer, Marco, the reason I ask is because I've been using GitHub Issues, which are not perfect, but it's just me, and it's not something that's actually that serious. But I find that I often have a thought of something I would like to do, but I'm not in a position to actually code it, even if it's something very quick. And so I'll make myself a little GitHub issue to just remind myself later on that I want to do that thing. And I haven't actually used this app for an analog edit because this is an off week. And I literally wrote the guts of it in about two consecutive mornings. And we won't record analog again until this upcoming week. And then we'll see if it works and what'll happen. But... Marco, do you use any sort? I think you had said you use like some text file or Todoist or not Todoist, like task paper or something like that. What do you do to manage bugs and planning and that sort of thing?
Yeah, for a while I used task paper as my like master to-do list for Overcast. When I had my to-do list renaissance about a year ago, and I switched to Things for like all my management on all devices. Now I just have a Things project that is Overcast. Okay. And under it, I have like all these headings for different version milestones I want to do. I know I'm not using it right, but I don't care.
Yeah, whatever.
I have a list in there of like bugs to fix for, you know, the next version. And whenever something comes up, I put it in there and then I try to fix it.
Gotcha.
So you wrote an iPad app and the app you wrote isn't a thin wrap around YouTube DL? with shortcut support or something?
No.
Say, hey, Dingus, download this video.
No, and actually, I should bring up, this actually probably should have been follow-up, but a lot of people wrote in and said, in various degrees of politeness, why don't you use shortcuts to do this? And it's a fair question, and there are two answers, neither of which will be satisfying to the people who have suggested this. Number one, it is not only YouTube that I do this sort of thing for. As an example, if you have a particular show on terrestrial television that you enjoy and you would like to persist a copy of them for the future, you can very easily use YouTube download to grab like an NBC show or CBS or whatever the case may be. As another example, we like to play a lot of holiday specials, holiday like music specials on endless repeat throughout the List household for the month of December, which is why nobody ever visits us in the month of December. But anyway, as an example, a night or two ago, Pentatonix, who is an a cappella group, did an extremely cheesy yet delightful Christmas special that was aired on NBC, and I wanted to keep it so I could watch it in the future. And so I YouTube DL'd it, and it worked no problem. And maybe shortcuts would work with these sorts of things too. I'm not sure. And given what shortcuts is capable of, I'm sure there is a way that it could be done. But I use YouTube DL for a lot more than just YouTube. And additionally, the real honest answer to the question of why not use shortcuts or SSH or something like that, or torrent them. Why torrent them when I can go to the actual source? But anyways, why not just like do something, anything else other than this ridiculous ISH thing? Is because I'm used to doing this on the command line. It's just momentum, man. I'm used to doing this on the command line. I know YouTube DL and FFmpeg alarmingly well now, which is not something I probably should be proud of. But it's just what I'm used to, and it's what I'm quickest with. And I like when I can use the tools I'm used to because I'm quick with them. And so that's why.
One of the reasons why, you know, going back to my iPad, you know, advanced options from the Mac thing earlier, one of the reasons why I find it difficult to become an iOS power user with shortcuts and formerly workflow is like the things you can do with it. Really, like this, it's like this, it's this whole layer of power and advanced features and automation that you can achieve. Well, we've had that for a while on other platforms, and for many of us, a lot of people going back decades, it's the terminal. It's, you know, a shell like Bash, and it's, you know, shell scripting and tools like this, command line tools. And One of the great things about learning the terminal is that once you know one of the common things like Bash and basic command line usage, first of all, you can use it on a whole bunch of different platforms. Mac OS, even Windows now with the WSL thing. You can use it on Linux servers. And it doesn't really change that much over time. Like you can learn a lot of these skills once, and then you can use those skills for like literally decades, like 20, 30 years easily. And a lot of the stuff doesn't change. Or at least like the foundation you built 30 years ago can still be used today. honestly, like, I think workflow and shortcuts, I think these actually are very much like the command line in the sense that they enable advanced users to learn some more complex things if they're willing to learn in order to get a lot of power, in order to you know, get new things done, get things done faster, have more customized behavior, more advanced behavior. The difference, though, is that, like, workflow and, or sorry, shortcuts is not the command line. It's totally different. And that's fine. I would say shortcuts is not that much easier to use than learning the command line is, in the sense that, like, you still need to learn how it works, what it expects, what it does and doesn't do. You still need to learn, like, its limitations, how it expects you to talk to it and use it. And you still need to, like, you know, learn the library of things it can do. So, like, there's a learning curve to both things. And the reason why people like me and Casey want so badly a terminal on the iPad is because we've already done that learning curve, like, 20 years ago or whatever, and we just want to be able to use it now because we can use it everywhere else. Like, that's why it's so awesome that the Mac is under the hood, like, this Unix subsystem. That's why Microsoft was so pressured to create the Windows subsystem for Linux thing, like, because once you're in that system, it's great because you have... You can have, like, this long-running expertise in this different language of how you can make your computer do amazing things. And you know the syntax, and you know the tools that you have at your disposal, and you can use the same knowledge and expertise and tools, even, on all the different platforms you use. And that's really awesome. So as awesome as shortcuts is for the people who use it, that doesn't apply to shortcuts. You can't use shortcuts anywhere except iOS. And so while it is awesome, it's not the same kind of thing, and it doesn't have the same long-term value of investing your expertise in and investing your, you know, your tools and your script and your time into as learning shell scripting does on any other platform. And so I kind of wish there was something like, you know, some kind of power user layer like this, whether it's, you know, something like shortcuts or something like a terminal that you can use on all of your devices. And right now there isn't. And if you could get a terminal on the iPad that was pretty good, you would have that if you were a terminal person. And so that's why we want this.
Additionally, you know, it used to be, I don't know if this is still the case, but it used to be years ago that you could jailbreak your phone and get, like, SSH access or even straight up terminal access and all sorts of stuff. So it feels as though this is just a completely synthetic, like, gate that Apple won't let us walk through. And I don't want to speak for you, but that really chaps my hindquarters that it's all there waiting for us. We just aren't allowed. And that's so frustrating.
Well, and, like, and I'm not even saying that I want to be able to go in and edit system config files. Like, I don't care about that. Make me a sandbox. Like, the apps run in sandboxes, literally, like, let me run, like, and this is actually what ISH kind of does. Like, let me run a terminal where I can install packages from, like, a package manager, like, whatever it might be, Brew, Yum, Swift thing, whatever it is, I don't care. Some package manager, let me install things like FFmpeg and any other tool I might want that might be in a repository like that, and compile stuff from source if I have to. Like, you know, give me the tools to do that, and give me a sandbox that I can put files in, and then I can, you know, open them in other apps. You know, so, like, I think one of the reasons why we don't have terminal for iPads yet is that nothing on the iPad really works that way with, like, a common file area. There is the Files app, but as our iPad power user friends always talk about, it's very limited. It's hard to get to those files from a lot of apps. It's very limited in what you can and can't do there. You don't really live in the files the way you do, like, on a Mac, where, like, your files are, like, all over your desktop and you're, like, living in your files all the time. On the iPad, it's this buried kind of, like, little back zone that they don't really want you going near, and not a lot of stuff supports. So, like, that, I think they need to address that first and make, like, the local file system more of a thing in iOS before they would go into something like considering a terminal.
There are some more fundamental issues they have to address in the core of iOS. I'm not aware of all the details, but I'm pretty sure the way the processes are managed is, like, it's one of the reasons you don't have multiple users for iOS devices already, is that it's not like it's not a multi-user system, because it is, but it's not as cleanly separated as a Mac is, which is, you know, based on the Next operating system, which was multi-user from day one, where the entire file system is cordoned off into sections for each user's stuff, and processes run as the logged-in user, with the exception of system processes. I think iOS has always played a little fast and loose with all that stuff. But I think if iOS continues along its current trajectory, especially if iPads keep getting bigger and more powerful and Apple eventually does like a Surface Studio type thing, it's inevitable that it will have a terminal. And you can get around the whole file sandboxing thing. It's like, yeah, of course it would be sandboxed, but you can basically mount in, you know, using not mounting, but, you know, a similar technology where from within your sandbox, you have visibility into the same sort of sections of the iCloud file system and the local file system that you own only through like a, you know, there's lots of existing Unix security features that act like this. There's lots of existing iOS features that would help them implement this. Like it's technically possible, but I think, you know, that there are, the iOS wasn't designed to do this from day one. So there's a lot of rejiggering they would have to do, and they're not going to disturb their, you know, flagship operating system for such an esoteric feature for until they've really gotten down to the bottom of the barrel in terms of features they need to add. Because if it was easy to add multi-user, I think they would have done it already for iPads. I mean, just look at what they did with the iPad for school thing with the multi-user support that basically like reboots the entire user space. It's, they didn't do that for the hell of it. It's like that was their best option at the time because it's just not set up for log in, log out like our Macs are. So you might be waiting a little while for that. On the command line and shortcuts issue, this is a good time for me to hoist up a topic that I had in the notes forever, which is related to this. I was thinking, when I wrote this in the notes, I was thinking about shortcuts and how we all know a bunch of people are super into them and they're doing really cool things with them. And I've been downloading shortcuts and messing with them. But like you guys, I haven't really gotten that into them. And I know why I haven't gotten that into them, because I've, I feel like I've, you know, been down this road before with these types of things. Like it's, and it doesn't mean that they're bad. I think they're great. And I think the people who are using them are, you know, excited to use them. But if you are a programmer, it's far, far less appealing. And in fact, it's kind of a turnoff to be asked to essentially write a little program with a bunch of GUI bubbles in a big, long, linear list from top to bottom with a limited level of indenting, with no functions or libraries, like it's, yeah, with no debugger. I mean, it's like, yeah, I could do it, but why would I put myself through that? So, when you're describing like the things you can do with the terminal, one of the most important things you can do with the terminal is write programs. And most of the programs that you can write in the terminal are in some kind of language that has a debugger and like just the basics of programming, right? So if you're a programmer, none of that scares you. You want to program. That's what I was thinking about shortcuts, is like the different levels of essentially programming on computers, right? So you've got the applications that just do what they do, that someone else wrote them, but you don't, you're just the user, right? So that's like the bottom level. You're not doing any programming. You're just using an application, tapping around, blah, 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 right? You've got something like shortcuts where now you have a series of things that it can do, and you've got conditionals and you've got loops, and it's like, go crazy, but you're not actually writing any code. And I saw a lot of people asking for, in shortcuts, I don't know if this already exists, maybe it does, but I've seen this in a lot of similar applications where there's one particular thing that you can do in this GUI sort of programming environment is do a thing here, and one of the ways you parameterize this thing is, oh, here's a text box. In the text box, you then finally get to write some kind of code, right? So it's like operation, conditional, loop, whatever, and then operation, oh, and arbitrary code. So like finally within this application where you're dragging blocks of stuff around, you get a text box and you get to finally write code just for this little tiny corner of your application, right? But for programmers, we want the whole thing to just be the code that we write. And like, it amazes me. I was messing with this today with some friends were talking on Slack about some Apple script thing, and they're using like JavaScript and Apple script. I opened up script debugger, or not script debugger. I've sort of jumped to the end there. I opened up script editor and I'm like, oh yeah, people write Apple script and there's no debugger. That's why an application called script debugger exists. How do you write any code without a debugger? Like, I don't, like, it's just,
you can be a PHP programmer.
It's like everyone's caught in the Stone Age, right? The JavaScript way was you debug it in Safari, right? So you can write the JavaScript that actually translates to the same stuff as AppleScript does, and you debug it in Safari. It's just, it's not attractive to, you know, all the things that you guys said about shortcuts is true, and, you know, limited to single platform and not general, whatever. But also, it is a total turnoff to anyone who's actually a programmer. Which, granted, that's not what this is for. If you're a programmer, fine, write programs. But this is for people who aren't programmers, to give them the ability to do things that programmers can do. But it is kind of like a ladder that you climb. I look at these giant things that Vitici's putting together. I'm like, well, he's essentially graduated now. Like, he's graduated out of shortcuts. He's ready now, more or less, to start writing actual programs. Because I mean, really, like some of these shortcuts are like, I think you saw one that was in the hundreds of commands. Maybe one was up into the thousands. And this is just one giant linear list from top to bottom with everything just inlined. And it's like how you write programs before you know how to write programs. And well, you didn't write any, but it's just a bunch of blocks. And then how do you debug it? And just, it's not attractive to me at all. And there's an analog to this having to do with the eternal debate that we are all having collectively in the Apple community about iOS versus the Mac, the operating systems in terms of how they deal with doing more than one thing at the same time. Multitasking is a simple way to put it, but you know, Windows is another way to put it in the menu bar and all that stuff. Those discussions we have, I think there is a direct analog to the way we've been discussing, like the sort of the way the Unix command line works and sort of the building blocks that it's based on. And contrasting that with shortcuts, which is this very regimented, simplified environment. Very similar to the way the Mac GUI works versus the way the iOS GUI works. But I haven't, I keep, it's one of those things, you know, when on this show where I make up like stupid analogies on the fly, I keep making up stupid analogies in my head on the fly about this, about how to correctly articulate the difference between these two things. And they're all really bad. So I'm holding it in for now. We'll save it. For another podcast, for another episode. If I ever come up with a good analogy, I have a bunch of ones that sound good, but then you think about them a little bit more and they're not really that great. But I'm just going to leave it for now. But I think it is very similar to the idea of like if you learn the basics of, the Unix shell and the way processes work in Unix and, you know, the basics of input-output redirection and the basics of one or two simple programming languages, you can use those building blocks to do whatever you want, more or less, and be comfortable and efficient. If you learn Apple shortcuts, best case scenario, you pull a Vitici and you very quickly graduate from the shortcuts program, which is great. Like, again, I'm not slamming shortcuts or saying everything should be a programming event. It shouldn't. There is absolutely a place for shortcuts, and it's great that it exists, and most people will never graduate from it. Like, most people will find shortcuts itself too inscrutable to use, right? We have a long way to go to make that kind of power accessible to people, but if you do actually climb all the way up that ladder, we need there to be a next step on iOS. And right now there isn't. The next step is basically get out Xcode and you can write your own app. That's it.
You know, a lot of times it's the developers who will say, like, we need something easy for everyone to use. But, like, there's an inherent level of complexity in shortcuts that, you know, because it is kind of like a programming environment. No matter what the syntax is, no matter, you know, whether you're typing code or dragging together blocks, the fact is it requires, like, logic and, you know, snapping together different pieces of functionality to do different things. And that itself is complexity that is beyond a lot of people. And so, I like whenever programmers try to like simplify things for other people who aren't them, you know, we've been trying to do that for like 40 years and we largely haven't succeeded very well. Like certain things break through, but you know, for the most part, they haven't. I would also say that Apple has said on a number of occasions recently that developers are their largest segment of pro users. So when you're pushing the iPad into pro territory, marketing wise and hardware wise, it does make sense to have it be a little bit more suitable for developers to use and to consider features that maybe only developers would ever use. But that's not a bad thing. Developers is not a bad word. We are users too. We buy a lot of Apple products that end in the word pro. It is not unreasonable to say, like, you know what, this environment that I'm asking for, like basically a terminal app for the iPad, like, that isn't that crazy of an idea for Apple to actually prioritize for their new pro platform that they want to jack up the prices for and charge as much as a laptop. And secondly, I know I said this already. I just really want to reiterate how awesome it is to teach yourself the command line because of the incredible breadth and longevity of that skill. Like even today, you know, you hear about somebody like Federico saying how awesome Homebridge is on a Raspberry Pi. You can run Homebridge on a Raspberry Pi. That's great. Raspberry Pis cost like between $10 and $30. They're amazing little computers. They are Linux computers. And if you know command line basics, you can very easily run a Raspberry Pi and have it do all sorts of fun things. You can run, in this episode, we were sponsored by Linode. You can get $5 a month. You can go buy a Linode server and have a server in the cloud that runs YouTube DL for you. And you can do all sorts of other stuff. All it takes is a little bit of command line knowledge. And the command line knowledge that I have, I learned in college in like 2001, and I use it for my very first job in 2004 through the present day and probably well into the future. There are very few things that programmers can say that they learned in college that they still use. Usually, you know, languages change, technologies change, the whole market changes. But that's something. We know that. We like shell scripting and basic command line usage and some of the, you know, Unix simple command line tools that are available. When you learn that, it has such long-term value, not only as a programmer, but even just as like a power user of a computer. The value of having that on a platform you use is very, very high. And the selling proposition of a platform that you use a lot, but that doesn't support that entire world of things, it's a really tough sell to make that a high-end or a high work getting done platform.
I think it's worth noting, though, that we are three old dudes who are lamenting the fact that our old technologies aren't available to us on this unbelievably cool new platform. And I stand by everything I've said, don't get me wrong. But it is a bunch of old dudes whining about old stuff not being there.
No, it's not about old thing, because like everything old is new again. Like the shortcuts thing is not old. Like I did HyperTalk and HyperCard, and I've done FileMaker databases, and I've done all sorts of GUI type environments of sort of, you know, simplifying programming. And like there's definitely a place for them. And in fact, there should be more and even easier solutions, because even shortcuts, I think, as Marco pointed out, is too complicated for most people. But none of those things. Like at a certain point, those things are harder than actually writing a program. Like I would much rather debug, a page or two of actual code than a 2,000 instruction shortcut. Because a page or two of regular code, I would get to use a code editor and, you know, an actual debugger, and it would make sense, and I would be able to understand what the language can do, and also, you know, like it would be documented. Like shortcuts is an application that you use, and it's like a little game you can play inside shortcuts and can do amazing stuff. But at a certain point, it's harder to hold a 2000 quote unquote instruction shortcut in your mind and reason about it and debug it and work on it and repeatedly run it and test it. And just, it's harder to do that than to write an actual program. Like, and that's true. Whether it's new or old, that's true. Whether you're trying to write a game in HyperTalk or whether you're trying to make an Excel spreadsheet play Tetris, like lots of things are possible. And you're like, wow, the Excel spreadsheet can play Tetris. That's amazing. But if you want to write Tetris, don't use Excel, right? So some of these things I see that the shortcuts are doing, it's not because we're old and it's not because we like Unix or whatever. They're just, their utility is in their ease of use and the ability to do simple things fairly easily, but hard things are barely possible. And if you are super into it, you will quickly reach the limit of where you should not be using shortcuts anymore. And there is a huge chasm between shortcuts and Xcode. And so that's the place where the command line might come in, where you're not ready to dive in and write an app in Xcode, but maybe you're ready to learn some basic command line stuff, download some open source packages in a safe sandbox type environment, and say, run YouTube DL to download something.
And you can have a programming environment there. You can run things like PHP and Python and Ruby, and like you can have all that running locally.
Yeah, that's a good place to learn. You know, I mean, they have that now with the Xcode playgrounds and stuff like that, but yeah, they could. Playgrounds is actually getting close to that type of environment, but it's still you're still kind of contained in the walls of the application. In this topic, which I just hoisted up to the top of the show notes, I had a bunch of other stuff in there with like apps versus apps that have loadable bundles versus code as data, which is the part where like, well, you're not writing code, but at some point this application will present you with a text box and you can paste code into that text box. So it's like a little escape hatch from the thing you're doing, and then shortcuts. And then writing actual code. So yeah, if you have, you know, obviously if you have a Unix environment, you could run Node right in there and just be off to the races and start, running and debugging stuff. But you know, there are quote unquote IDEs, command line IDEs and command line debuggers. Like I'm very comfortable using those things, and that's more of an old man thing. But stuff like shortcuts, that type of GUI programming environment, it has its limits, regardless of when it, you know, whether it's new technology, old technology. It's not because we're old, man. It's because, A, it's because we're programmers, and B, it's because there is that huge gap between a GUI thing where you can make programs and programming in Xcode. And, you know, I don't think it's up to Apple to bridge that gap. That was the old 70s view of technology. Eventually, everyone who uses a computer will be a programmer. That's not true. Like, everyone who drives a car won't be a mechanic. Everyone who uses a computer won't be a programmer. That will never happen. That was a wrong-headed way to think about things. The reason I think people thought that in the 70s is because the people saying that were programmers, and they realized the incredible power of being a programmer. It's like, if you're a programmer and you have easy access to a computer, essentially, a computer of your very own in your own house, you can do amazing things. And they're like, wouldn't it be great if everybody had this power? Yeah, it would, but they're not going to. Like, it's not a thing that everyone will do. Like, it would be great if everyone had the ability to fashion their own furniture out of wood, but they don't, and they won't, and it will never, ever happen, as cool as it might you might think it would be. So that dream has definitely died. But, I, you know, what we're talking about is, I can think of a thing that my device can do. I just need to, like, it's capable of doing it. It just, I want it to do it, like, all at once. Like, I want to give it a series of instructions, and maybe with some conditions, and I want it to do that so I don't have to manually do it. Like, you know, sort of my first program. Can you give me a way to do that? Can you do, that's why they call it automation. Like, I'm not actually programming. I'm just telling the computer a series of things to do, maybe with some conditionals in there. So it's automation. It's not programming. But it's the exact same thing. It's just a continuum from I don't do anything except for press buttons at a program someone else wrote to I write my program. And in that continuum, there are huge gaps. There's the gap way at the beginning between nothing and shortcuts. Then there's this little island of shortcuts. And then that peters off into the ocean. And there's a giant ocean. And then there's Xcode way out on the right-hand side. And even in Xcode, you're like, well, but it's not jailbroken. And the other side of Xcode is like jailbroken iPhone. And now you're writing the operating system and stuff like that. So I'm still working on the analogy/metaphor for my GUI thoughts. I really hope someone doesn't write like a blog post that says exactly what I've been wanting to say for like 6 months, but they probably inevitably will as I ruminate on the perfect analogy.
We are sponsored this week by Betterment, the smart way to manage your money. Betterment gives you technology designed to help you make more from your investments. They do this by combining cutting-edge technology and human expertise. Really, it's the investing tool for those who refuse to settle for average investing. So Betterment's unlimited expert advice helps you make smart financial decisions, and their technology helps you make more from your investments. So for instance, they have tax-efficient investing strategies that give you an edge. And they can also guide you along the way with human experts with advice to help you make smart financial decisions. And they bring all this to you for one low, transparent fee. You can use Betterment to plan for retirement, reach your financial goals, and just generally make the most of your money. Don't settle for average investing. Demand better. For more information, go to betterment.com/ATP. Investing involves risk. Once again, betterment.com/ATP, and you can get up to 1 year managed free. Thank you so much to Betterment for sponsoring our show. Betterment, outsmart average.
Drew Shannon writes, hey, for most quote-unquote normal macOS usage, what are the pros and cons of using something like Dropbox or Google Drive as a primary storage solution so nothing is exclusively saved locally? Seems like a no-brainer for portability and backups, but what am I missing? I don't know. That just seems like it wouldn't be wise because it would be so chatty over the network. Maybe? I guess on the surface, there's nothing that strikes me as, oh, this is a terrible decision. But it is not something I've ever thought to myself, ooh, I want this in my life. So I don't know. Let's leave John, Mr. File Systems, for the end. Marco, any thoughts on this?
I mean, I would say one of the obvious ones is privacy of that data. I mean, that's a big thing. Like, mm-hmm. You know, like, and as John will probably point out, like certain jobs and professions, you actually either shouldn't or like legally can't store your primary documents or a lot of your documents in public storage places like this. Like, you also are stressing that process, that like the sync process, the system for doing it, you are going to have probably poor performance of that process if you have a whole lot of files there. And then finally, you're basically having a giant single point of failure. Now, I don't think it matters that much in if you have other systems in place. So for instance, you know, Dropbox, I don't know how Google Drive works. Dropbox is just a folder on your file system, and there's a background process that syncs to and from it, basically, into their cloud thing. And so you can do things like run Time Machine or run internet backup like Backblaze or things like that that will include those files because they're just files sitting there on your disk. So you can have like different levels of backup, and you definitely should if that's like your primary storage. Because yes, Dropbox is wonderful, and yes, it has like version support, but what if it breaks? What if your account gets suspended? What if they have a problem? What if you go to restore a file and it just says, "Oh, sorry, server error, can't do it." You know, it's always nice to have your own backups in some other form in addition to whatever they're doing. So I would say like it can be a single point of failure that you want to avoid, but you know, it doesn't need to be. In addition to that, having your primary thing be something that is synced introduces the potential for sync bugs to wipe it out. So you could log in one day, and as soon as you connect to the Wi-Fi, Dropbox starts deleting all the files in your Dropbox because some sync problem has happened, or maybe your account was hacked, but chances are, you know, I think a bug is more likely. You know, something has happened, and it's blowing away all your files. And you might notice, you might not notice in time. It might blow away some of your files, and then you don't notice until it is too late, and the things that were blown away are no longer in any of your backups or their version control system. So like it's kind of shaky in a few areas, but if it's like a secondary computer, like a laptop, then the calculus changes. Like if you have like a primary desktop or something at home, and you have like, you know, a MacBook One or something, and you're trying to like just have a few things on this and just have that thing be expendable, that's a different story. So it depends on how you're using it, but there are definitely some pitfalls that you might want to consider and try to avoid.
John?
I think you guys covered most of it. The philosophical problems with it is starting to think that because you use one of these cloud drive services that you don't need a backup, that this constitutes your backup. Well, Dropbox saves old versions, so even if I accidentally delete the file, I can get it back. None of these things are backup solutions. Don't trust them for that. The main difference between a backup solution and these things, like Marco pointed out, these things are not you do stuff in the local file system and it puts them into the cloud. It's bidirectional. It's sync, right? Which has bugs and problems, but the main difference between it and a cloud backup service is that a cloud backup service never deletes anything off your drive. It just takes things off your drive and puts them into the cloud. At no point does, you know, Backblaze, frequent sponsor of the show, decide, "See that file on your hard drive? That shouldn't be there. Let me delete it." That will never happen. It's not the job of Dropbox to delete stuff. It's the job of Dropbox to see what's there and stick it up in the cloud. One direction only. If you want to do a restore from Dropbox, that's a whole other process that you have to manually initiate. It's not going to randomly happen. And then practically speaking, depending on what you're doing, and Marco pointed out the performance things, like if you know, I wouldn't put a Git repository on Dropbox or Google Drive. I know from experience that if you do npm install on Dropbox or Google Drive and you're doing node development, it will catch up eventually with what you're doing, but it becomes so far from real time and just slaughters your computer that you end up having to say, well, let me turn off Dropbox or Google Drive. If you can, you can't turn off iCloud Drive. Let me turn it off, do my development, and then turn it back on later and let it sync. And at that point, you're now doing this manual system. You're going to forget to turn it back on, or you're going to accidentally delete something. You don't realize it was synced, and it's like you are eliminating the benefit. So you really, given the technological limitations, there is no sort of automatic, transparent, oh, I do stuff locally, and it just magically goes up to the cloud. The best we have is sort of an asynchronous way to make that happen eventually. And the safest way to do that is to just do your development locally. You can put some things in Dropbox or Google Drive, but have a backup system that takes your entire drive and puts it one direction from your Mac up into the cloud and have that be your safety net. So we're stuck saying some files have to be local, some files can be in Google Drive or Dropbox, and you have to run a backup utility, and you have to be conscious of which things are in which locations. It's cruddy, but that's life.
Justin Winchester writes, "I've just over 5,000 movies and TV show episodes all stored on a Drobo. I run Plex on a 5K iMac." That sounds familiar. "But I'm looking at getting a dedicated computer to just run my Plex server. I thought an old Mac Mini would be good for this, and I found several on Craigslist, but I've also found some 2010 era Mac Pros. Would it be beneficial to get a Pro over a Mini for basically the same price?" And then there's some details that he provides about his Drobo, and then he continues. "So should I even consider the older Macs? All my videos are MKV or M4V, so I don't believe the Mac has to do any transcoding, as I believe my devices can play those files natively. So what should I do?" Well, I actually exchanged a couple emails with Justin, and I was not the one who put this on the show notes. So I presume one of you has some thoughts on this. But what I had initially recommended was actually an NVIDIA Shield. And to be fair, I don't know very much about this at all. But a friend of the show, Bradley Chambers, has used these in the past and says that they're really, really good. And you can actually, to the best of my knowledge, check my math on this, you can actually run a Plex server on the NVIDIA Shield. And as far as I understand, Justin actually did some research on this, and according to him, it can only do like two or three simultaneous streams, either because of the constraints of the processor or because of, you know, some sort of artificial limitation. Again, check my math on this, but I guess Justin, he said privately to me, often has many people all streaming from him simultaneously, so that probably wouldn't work for him. And if that's the case, I would say just get a new Mac Mini. You'll be surprised what else you can do with it. And I have not spoken to him much, but I understand that other friend of the show, Mike Hurley, has just gotten himself a Mac Mini. So I'm basically one step away from flying to London and installing Plex on that Mini for him. So I would say if you have light uses, take a look at an NVIDIA Shield. If you're more like Justin and running a mini Netflix out of your house, then something like a Mac Mini. Either of you guys, other thoughts?
Justin may be the only person cross-shopping a Mac Pro tower and a Mac Mini. They seem so similar. I can't decide. They're the same price. One of them is the size of a house. You could fit like 20 Mac Minis inside a Mac Pro case, like stacked on top of each other. They're not comparable in any way. I mean, I guess he's got some place so he can tuck them away, but like the power that the Mac Pro would use, please don't buy a 2010 Mac Pro to be your Plex server. That is the rule. It's like, I'm not even going to say it's overkill because it's slower than the Mac Mini. It's just giant and it's ridiculous. Don't do it. The other question that you glossed over in the middle, and one of the reasons I put this in here, was worried about like, oh, I have a Drobo and it has USB 3, but if I got a 2010 Mac Pro, it wouldn't have USB 3. Again, don't get a Mac Pro tower. It's ridiculous. But for the transfer speeds, I don't think any modern computer, it doesn't really matter how many streams, sequential data reading, especially from SSDs, but even from spinning disks, especially for compressed media files, should be adequate to serve tons of streams of almost anything. Like it shouldn't worry too much about the I/O. I suppose if you have a 2010 machine, maybe worry a little, but don't get a 2010 machine. Get a recent thing, whether it's a Mac Mini or I don't know what the NVIDIA Shield's I/O is like or whatever, but unless you are serving like an entire town streaming from your thing, which you probably shouldn't be anyway, like even if it's your entire immediate and extended family streaming from your Plex, any modern small computer will do just fine. So please don't buy a Mac Pro. The Shield thing, I don't know. I mean, you can check it out. It's cheap. It might be fun to get into, but a Mac Mini would totally crush this task and would be awesome. If I had $800 to spend on a Plex server and wanted to get a Mac, that's what I would get.
Same. Marco, any other thoughts?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, you know, I was going to point out the power usage difference if John didn't. Like, you know, if they're the same buy-in price now, but for a computer that you run 24/7, power consumption will actually probably add up to real money. And so the Mac Pro will definitely use more power. I would also, you know, remind everybody, as you touched on, that, you know, you'd be getting, you know, USB 2.0 only. People don't realize how old the tower Mac Pros are until you point out the fastest I/O they have is FireWire 800.
My word.
They are pre-USB 3 and pre-Thunderbolt. Thunderbolt 1. Like, they don't have Thunderbolt 1 or USB 3. I would also say that regarding the NVIDIA Shield, I know Federico Vaticci, if we didn't make his head explode enough with all the iPad and shortcuts talk, I'm pretty sure he had an NVIDIA Shield, I think. I know he had something like that. I think that was it, to do exactly this, to be a Plex server. And he has since moved on to a different setup because it didn't work out. And I forget the details of why it didn't work out, but I'm pretty sure it was not a favorable review of that setup. So,
oh, okay.
So I wouldn't recommend that. You know, look, if you're considering two Macs, like, yeah, just get a Mac, and the Mac to get for this purpose is definitely the Mac Mini. And you don't even need to spec it up. Like, if you're using external storage for all your stuff, you can get the base model. Like, you don't need you don't need more than the i3 is likely to deliver, like, processor wise. It, you know, the GPU is going to be the same awful GPU in all of them, so there's no upgrade to have there. I don't think this is a very RAM heavy workload, so you don't need to upgrade the RAM either. I think get the base model Mac Mini and enjoy the energy savings and much smaller size and the ability to use I/O that was invented in this decade.
And actually, real-time follow-up from XMN in the chat. There's apparently a Plex equivalent of a KBase article specifically enumerating some of the limitations of running a Plex server on the Shield. So again, it's probably the cheapest and easiest way to fix this problem if you don't have the needs that Justin appears to have. But it's worth checking out. We'll put a link in the show notes. All right. And then finally, Eric Wagner writes, I was wondering if you guys ever had an issue balancing work and play. If so, what do you do to solve this issue? For example, I'm a computer science major and a lot of my work is done on the computer, but I also enjoy playing video games on said computer. And then there's video game talk, whatever. I've been playing this tug of war with, should I do homework or should I do my daily missions? Unfortunately, the latter has been winning out more often than it probably should be. How do you suggest I resist this relentless urge?
Daily missions in what, Casey?
I don't care.
What does that mean, daily missions?
I don't care. It's in some stupid game.
I was gonna ask about this. Like, this is definitely like you know, when I was a kid in college learning computer science with a computer full of games and trying to balance it, there like games were so much less exploitive and addictive and, you know, constantly online. Like
Total Annihilation? I don't know. Network play. Network play is the ultimate time sink.
Yep, that was Counter-Strike for me.
Yeah, you know, I didn't have any daily missions. Yeah, it was TA, it was Counter-Strike, it was later Return to Castle Wolfenstein, stuff like that. But, like, I never had that big of a problem, in part because my college had awful internet connectivity, and so the ping times were too high to play most of those games reasonably. But I think, you know, the games now, they're so much more addictive and immersive, and they like take over your life to a greater degree for more people than they did back then. So it's a little hard to answer. But my actual answer to this really is get a Mac, because you won't be able to play any games. Gaming on a Mac is so painful and punitive, you won't want to do it. And you can still do all your computer science work on it.
It's interesting. Interesting answer. I did not expect, to be honest with you. I don't have good advice on this, and it's definitely do as I say, not as I do, because I was a terrible student in college. And it wasn't specifically because of video games, although it was part of it. Marco and I were in school when EverQuest was a thing. And I remember there were literally many kids who dropped out of college because they spent so much time on EverQuest, which was one of the earlier massively multiplayer online games. I'm sure it wasn't the first, but it was one of the first ones that was popular enough that I had heard about it. And this is, to my knowledge, before World of Warcraft was a thing. And so, yeah, there were a lot of kids that lost their college careers to EverQuest. But the best advice I can give is that, look, hopefully this is 4 years of your life, which seems like a heck of a long time, especially if you're 18. But in actuality, is not that long. And if you can just build the skill by force, by reward, by punishment, any way you can, of doing what you need to do and getting that over with as quickly as possible, so you can go and play games until you keel over, that is a skill that will be useful forever. And if you can do it at least for these 4 years, then hopefully you will find a decent enough paying job that you can basically slack off anytime you're not at work for pretty much the rest of your life. And that's a pretty good trade. 4 years for the rest of your life, I would make that trade. And so I know that's not really the most concrete advice or actionable advice, but just suck it up for 4 years, man. You could do it. I have faith in you.
I do love your philosophy of just work now so you can be a slacker forever.
Yeah, seriously. That's the idea.
That's fantastic. Hey,
if we could only all be so lucky. John, what's some actually useful advice?
The suggestion to get a Mac isn't really going to help, because there are network games in the Mac too. And even though there aren't that many of them and they're not as good in general, there it just takes one. That's the problem. It only takes one.
All right, modified statement. Get a MacBook Air.
Or a MacBook. Yeah,
the GPU is so bad that it's fast enough. Actually, no, even better idea. Get one of the new Mac Minis, because it's the worst GPU in the lineup, but it's totally a great system for development. So you can do your homework, you know, whatever you need on, you can do it on the Mac Mini, but the GPU is so awful that probably every game would be nearly unplayable. So yeah, get a Mac Mini and get the biggest monitor you can, so that GPU is really working hard.
You're forgetting about streaming games.
Oh, is that a thing?
Where it doesn't run locally, runs in the cloud, and you can play your MMO because you don't care about lag, because it's not like a real-time combat game. Like, there's no escape. That's
right.
The thing about
Wait, no, now there is. I got it. Mac Mini plus the aforementioned network link conditioner.
Network link conditioner.
Simulate my college connection. You'll have no problem at all.
I mean, there's no escape from this. Like, this is a thing you're going to have to deal with for your whole life, of things that you have to do versus things that you want to do. Often in college, it's when people are first faced with that, because if before college, like if you're living at home with some authority figure who tells you what you have to do versus what you want to do, and then when you're off in college, it's just you telling yourself that. This is a life skill you're just going to have to figure out, all right? And so, you know, this... If you have to go cold turkey off something, I know some people who, you know, got into MMOs and or MUDs or mushes or other things that predate that, like basically anything with network effects, the network based game. If you have to go cold turkey off it to get your to get yourself to do what you have to do, then that's what you have to do. If you can learn to moderate it, fine, but it's not going to go away. Like that, your parents aren't going to come back and start running your life again. You're going to go off on your own. You're going to be face the same problem. Do I, you know, do what I have to do? Do I go shopping and do my laundry, or do I play video games? Like, it doesn't work out well if you can't get this balance. So take this time in college to figure out how to get that balance for yourself. Hopefully you don't have to go cold turkey and everything, but if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. Don't be one of those people Casey described that actually fails out of college before it, because it doesn't get easier after that. It's not like, well, my college experiment failed, but it's smooth sailing from here. Nope. You'll still have to get a job and support yourself and... you know, do your laundry and make yourself food and bathe and find some way to support yourself. Like, it doesn't go away. So I guess I don't have any great advice on how to do it, just that it's not a problem that's unique to college. And you better learn how to deal with it.
And also just like, you know, to conclude, like philosophically, as one slacker to another, I can tell you that you're never going to, if you're having these issues like this, you know, you're probably a slacker like me. You're probably never going to have an amazing work ethic, but what you do need to learn, and college is pretty good for this, is learning how to tell what you do and don't have to really do. Because in most college, you know, curriculums, I don't know, in most plural college curriculum, it's pretty much impossible for one person in a single day to do all of the work that was assigned or recommended to them in all their classes. So you kind of have to develop these skills for knowing how to tell what you don't have to do and prioritizing things. You know, and as John was saying, like, you know, figuring out how to balance things you want to do versus things you have to do. But learning how to tell what you don't have to do is possibly the most valuable skill you can possibly learn in your entire academic career. It's a skill that not everybody does learn. But it's, you know, for everybody, not just slackers like us, but for everybody, that's a very, very important skill to learn. Because, again, there isn't enough time in the day to do everything, but you also can't do nothing and just play games all day. Like, you have to get somewhere in the middle there, and that is a skill that, as John has said much better than this, college is a pretty opportune time to learn that skill.
And for Destiny, that's the game, by the way, obviously, that he was talking about, Destiny specifically. As someone who can't play Destiny all the time because there's stuff I have to do, it is possible to play and enjoy Destiny at a slower pace. You can play one night a week and still make reasonable progress in the game. Bungie has done a pretty good job of making a game that you can play obsessively all day, every day, if you're a professional, you know, Twitch streamer, and you can also play once a week. And the once a week people will progress more slowly, but you can still play and enjoy the game at a reasonable pace. Usually by the time a season is over in Destiny, I have just hit the light level cap and I've more or less done all the major things that were in that content. It's what everybody did who's a Twitch streamer the first week it came out. The first week the expansion came out. It takes me an entire season to do it, but I do get to all the content. So don't feel like you're going to miss it. So if you have to make a schedule, say, look, I get 4.5 hours to play Destiny on Saturday, and that's all the only time I ever play Destiny. And you will not miss out on any content. You'll just progress more slowly.
All right, thanks to our sponsors this week, Casper, Betterment, and Linode. And we will talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCO ARMENT Marco Arment SIRAC USA Syracuse. It's accidental.
I have this e-tron GT concept, which shows that Audi is really committed to this e-tron brand, but it also shows that potentially they're going to make something other than a squashed SUV. So maybe when Marco's leases,
this looks good.
I mean, this is a coupe, obviously, but like what it means is that this is probably the same platform. And so obviously the squished SUV is the first one because that's the car that everybody's going to buy because only people only buy SUVs. But it seems like they might actually make a sedan and this coupe thing eventually.
This is pretty.
It looks like they're definitely like taking a lot of cues from the BMW I series. Like, you know, and this, like, they're using like the sustainable interior. Everything's vegan. They're using a vowel as their branding thing. I do think that the BMW I series is way better branding than e-tron.
Yeah, no, e-tron's not a good name.
Like, e-tron sounds like one of the Lego sets I would have played with in the 90s and 80s, not like a car in 2018 that's supposed to be like a forward looking thing. Like, it sounds so old.
What the hell is that? I think Volvo has one too. I keep wanting to say Polaris, but I'm thinking of Polaris Lance from Destiny because I just talked about it. Thought they have like a premium brand, and I thought their premium Polestar, maybe. Let's see.
That's their performance stuff.
That's hybrid. Oh, never mind. Well, anyway, Volvo styling has Volvo's really been on a tear with the styling lately. So if they ever make a full electric car, I bet it'll look nice. I think this Audi GT looks really nice, but this is just a concept car, so. Like, who the hell knows what they're actually going to make?
It actually does look nice. I mean, I don't have a lot of use for a two-seater.
Yeah, no, just imagine, like, it's the same platform. I'm sure this is all whatever their midsize electric car platform is. Like, it's exactly what's underneath the e-tron. Just imagine a four-door version of that with reasonable proportions, because Audis all tend to look the same anyway. So you can very quickly visualize, oh, I can see what a four-door version of that would look like with reasonable wheels on it.
Why is there e-tron on the front gaping mouth?
Because they're, as Marco pointed out, they're very bad at branding. Like, the worst thing about e-tron is that it highlights the fact that it's their electric car, which is going to be look more and more ridiculous as every car is electric. It's like naming your gasoline car like the cylinder masher or the, you know,
the fuel injector.
Yeah. Or like, yeah, just it doesn't the piston pumper. Like, there's certain points like, what is his name supposed to highlight to me? That it has an internal combustion engine? Okay, great, good.
Yeah, it's like I feel like these car companies like Audi and to some degree BMW and definitely Honda and Toyota, like that kind of company, I feel like relegating the electric efforts to a sub brand is probably a bad idea. Like, they already have these amazing, like, successful, long-running car platforms and models and brands. They should just do, like, what everybody wants is just make those electric. Like, give an option for, make an electric Accord option. Make an electric Camry.
That's what everyone's going to do eventually, but this is, like, the dipping the toe in the water. I mean, like, Volkswagen just came out and said they're not going to make internal combustion engines anymore, period, after the upcoming generation of platforms that they build on. So it's still a slightly longer timeline, but yeah, they're going to convert everything. And even Honda, I think, has mostly learned the lesson of don't make dedicated models. Honda doesn't do any EV because, like I said, they're really slow. But just take hybrids. Don't have dedicated models for hybrids. And also, don't make your hybrids look weird. Like, that was the thing in the beginning. Oh, your hybrid has to look like a Prius. It has to look like a little snail turd or whatever. If you look at what they did with the new Insight, the Insight just looks like a Honda now. They stopped, for the most part, they're still hanging on a little bit, but they stopped making them all look weird and Nissan Leafy or whatever. It's like, just make a normal Honda car and then have a discreet little hybrid bed. And of course, there is a hybrid Accord. There is a Civic Accord. And those look exactly like hybrid Civic, rather. Those look exactly like Civics and Accords. They just have a little badge and uglier wheels, usually, and a slightly uglier grill. But otherwise, they're exactly the same cars. Yeah, someone in the chat room pointed out that Honda's hydrogen efforts. Honda's off in the weeds on this whole topic. But yeah, everyone will eventually just have all their cars just be normal. But in the beginning, there is some advantage to making a bit of a splash by naming your thing e-tron or by making your i3 look like this weird refrigerator on wheels, like, and making everything out of wood sustainably and having a little flower growing out of the dashboard. Like, that's how you get into the market. But
Well, but that's how you get into the market like 5 years ago. I feel like now, like
even today,
doing this kind of stuff now, it's a little late for that.
No.
Like it'd be like if somebody came out now with a brand new hybrid line and they really touted it and sub-branded it, and it's like, no, that's old now. Like we like when the very first hybrids came out, like the very first like Prius and Honda, was it the inside, like the very first like consumer mm-hmm. hybrids, when those came out, that was the time to do like, you know, crazy styling and really call attention to the fact that it's a hybrid. But I feel like with electric cars, like we are already like at like the phasing out part of the adoption curve here, where we're already at the point where like you should like reduce the amount that you call attention to the fact that it's electric and just make a really good electric car.
You are crazy.
Yeah, because we're not at that point, first of all. But look at the styling on this. This just looks like an Audi. Like, the styling of this Audi says nothing about it. The only thing it says electric is the stupid name and the fact that they put the name on the front. But otherwise, it looks like a straight-up Audi. And the same thing with the Jaguar. It looks like a squished SUV, like all their other squished SUVs. Like, the styling era is already over before these people have even made their first electric car. But we are still in early days of electric cars, period.
Yeah, I will agree that the e-tron GT concept thing is actually a very nice looking car. And yes, you're right. With the exception of the stupid thing on the intake non-grill, it doesn't. Is that even? It's a fake intake grill, isn't it?
Yeah, it's blocked off. Why would you need air to go in there?
Right. Yeah. So the giant e-tron branding on the fake intake grill, I think, is a mistake. But other than that, like if they just deleted that and the grill and. You know, if you take that out, it actually does look very, very nice. But it looks like a very nice version of a car I don't need.
I think the problem that you're running into, Marco, with regard to where we are in the timeline of electric cars is that you've lived with one for 3 years now. But to any regular, I don't mean this to sound dismissive and I apologize, but to any like regular person with regular cars, they still seem like a foreign concept. Like I've probably spent more time driving an electric car than many, given that I don't own one. You know, I've driven underscores cars plenty of times. I don't recall if I've actually driven yours, but it ultimately doesn't matter. The point is I've spent a fair bit of time behind the wheel of a Tesla, and I am pretty familiar with what they are and how they work, but most people I know like have never really even been in an electric car, much less owned one or driven one or owned one. So I think we're far earlier in the adoption than I think you're giving them credit for.
Well, I'm not saying they're like every day, but like, you know, the time that it was like really crazy unique for an electric car to be an electric car is fading already. Like we're already,
yeah,
like,
okay.
And so if you are debuting a new model in like the next 2 to 4 years, and you're planning on starting this big sub brand of your company for electric, like that's, I think the time for that has passed. It is still novel. And you're right. Most people don't have them yet, but like, I mean, geez, like look at the number of Model 3s Tesla has shipped. It's getting pretty mass market at a pretty accelerating pace. And if Tesla wasn't such a, you know, crazy, poorly run company for operations, I think there'd be even more of them. And so it's only a matter of time before other companies come in and have products that are as compelling as the Model 3 and Model S and sell in similar volumes. We only need like one or two more of those before this becomes very common for a lot of people. Whether they own one or not is a different story.
They have to get cheaper still.
Yeah, they do. But it's going to become as boring as like owning a BMW. Like, yeah, most people don't own BMWs, but most people also don't care that much about them. Like, they aren't that novel anymore. They might have been novel 40 years ago, but they're not very novel now. So that's why I think we're getting there with electrics faster than a lot of these car companies seem to think, where it's no longer going to be like, hey, look at us, give us a big hand for going all electric. Like, if you go all electric like in 10 years, no one's going to give you a big hand. That's just table stakes at that point.